Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the New Yorker political scene. This is Russ Finkelstein, your host, and I would like to wish all of the Jewish listeners today a Happy New Year, Shana Tova, Happy Year 5784. I wish you all a contemplative and redemptive High Holy Days. I have a very special episode of the podcast for you. Like a lot of people, I know that it's an election year, and I know that there's politics happening here in the United States, but I found it nearly impossible to think about anything these days other than what's happening in the Middle East. And so when I listened to this week's episode of the New Yorker political scene and realized not only do they not discuss the issue whatsoever, this week's episode of that podcast is actually a breakdown of the gender gap in the 2024 election. And they spoke to a pollster about how the two candidates are performing with men and with women. In very short summation, Kamala Harris is performing better with women, and Donald Trump is performing much better with men. So instead of sloshing around in the mud this week, I thought to myself, you know who I would really love to speak to? My friend Dalal Mawad. She's a journalist and an author from Lebanon and has done a lot of great reporting there, including the book she wrote about the 2020 Beirut explosion, All She Lost, as well as a recent article in New Lines magazine that profiles young men who died fighting for Hezbollah and their mothers. It's touching and also very insightful. I will include a link to both of those in the description of this episode, and I also recommend that you follow Dalal on social media, on Instagram or on X, formerly known as Twitter, where she posts a lot of her TV appearances. She's been doing a lot more of those as Israel ramps up its attacks on Lebanon. So following the wave of bombings and explosions and the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah, and now Israel's ground invasion of southern Lebanon, I thought perhaps it might make a refreshing reprieve from our normal trudgery to have an in-depth conversation about Lebanon, Israel, and Hezbollah with someone who knows those topics quite well and who happens to be a very good friend of mine. But before we get to my conversation with Dalal, I did just want to give an update on something I talked about last week. A lot of you might have seen that Ta-Nehisi Coates was making the rounds with various media appearances to promote his new book. Now, we discussed an article about that book that's called The Message on last week's episode. I want you to listen to the way that Coates was confronted by CBS anchor Tony DeCoppel. This is the first question he was asked by DeCoppel.
Ta-Nehisi, I want to dive into the Israel-Palestine section of the book. It's the largest section of the book. And I have to say, when I read the book, I imagine if I took your name out of it, took away the awards and the acclaim, took the cover off the book, the publishing house goes away, the content of that section would not be out of place in the backpack of an extremist. And so then I found myself wondering, why does Ta-Nehisi Coates, who I've known for a long time, read his work for a long time, very talented, smart guy, leave out so much? Why leave out that Israel is surrounded by countries that want to eliminate it? Why leave out that Israel deals with terror groups that want to eliminate it? Why not detail anything of the first and the second intifada, the cafe bombings, the bus bombings, the little kids blown to bits? And is it because you just don't believe that Israel, in any condition, has a right to exist?
Well, I would say the perspective that you just outlined, there is no shortage of that perspective in American media.
I think Ta-Nehisi Coates handled this situation incredibly well. And if you haven't seen it already, go watch it on YouTube. The whole exchange is really something to behold. I bring it up in part because it's a good segue from last week's conversation to my conversation with Dalal, but it's also a justification to read this incredible, hilarious article written by Tony DeCoppel in the New Statesman magazine back in April of 2014. So more than 10 years ago, before DeCoppel divorced his Jewish wife and married Katie Tour. And I think it would only be fair to issue a trigger warning at this point. This article does contain a depiction of adult male circumcision of Tony DeCoppel's penis. Ultimately, though, this story seems to be about the zealotry of the recently converted, which might be what's actually behind DeCoppel's offensive line of questioning with Ta-Nehisi Coates. The headline of this article by Tony DeCoppel is "My Adult Circumcision, How I Made the Cut for My New Religion." I understand the world doesn't usually think much about adult male circumcision. It's like having a chat about ball trampling or the Pentagon's Kevlar underwear. Even on the covered wagon side of the circumcision wars, where people fight for foreskins of baby boys, no one wants to talk about grown men getting their corn shucked. Take it to Craigslist, please. I get all this and so much more. And yet, as someone who knows the sting of this particular ritual, who volunteered for it, in fact, and signed his own check to the part-time reaper who did the job, I have to say, it's not so bad. There's no need for any of us to go on treating our junk like our father-in-law's scratch-free Ferrari. It's much tougher than you think. I came to this knowledge on the way to the altar of all places. I was engaged to a nice Jewish girl taking some free conversion classes at a big progressive Manhattan synagogue. I wanted to learn about something that mattered to her, and the more I learned, the more it mattered to me too. Medically speaking, I was already circumcised, along with most other babies born in America in the 80s. But that's no good for God. I needed the Hatafat Dam Brit, a drawing of blood. To remain uncut, I was told, is to remain spiritually cut off from the Jewish people. That's the idea of the covenant. That's how I found myself biblically nude in a kind of spiritual locker room, a shower space in a converted brownstone, waiting on a man with a razor. When the moil arrived, he looked, I'm sorry to say, like Danny DeVito in Curls. We stood in silence. I opened my towel. Hello, groin. He opened a shaving bag with glinting instruments. Hello, knife. My moil produced a pen-sized lance, which he wielded ever so gently, like Lady Grantham with a paring knife. He sliced, sliced, squeezed, dripped, and it was done. The whole transaction was over in seconds, long before I could scream or faint, or decide if I liked it. Instead, I felt the way I remembered feeling as a child, rising early. I could watch light fall in the woods behind my house, revealing nothing at all scary. When the moil finally spoke, he spoke in Hebrew, and I couldn't make out a word of it. But I had the feeling that the substance of his words was important, and that if I could understand him, I would be in the possession of something profound, a message from God. It's only a penis. And there you have it, this floridly written horror story about what motivated Tony DeCoppola to pursue an adult male circumcision, and the line between how he got from there to that aggressive interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates should be the plot of the next Coen Brothers movie. I know the circumcision and your subsequent divorce from the woman who made you get that circumcision must have hurt, Tony, but that is not Ta-Nehisi's fault. Anyway, I'm sorry to have put us all through this. Mostly, I'm sorry, Dalal, if you are listening to this. It is a little bit embarrassing. But in my defense, I did not write that article. Tony DeCoppola did. And I would not have had to read it if he hadn't have done such an atrocious interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates, who we covered last week on this show. Anyway, before I embarrass myself even further, here's my conversation with the great Dalal Mawad. Dalal, thank you so much for joining me on the New Yorker political scene.
Thank you for having me, Russ.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. And just so our audience knows, me and you are friends. We went to journalism school together at Columbia Journalism School in New York, along with my previous guest, Will Sloan, who is also in our RW1 class, as you remember.
Yes, of course. He's unforgettable.
The unforgettable Will Sloan, of course.
Yeah, you're not just my friend, Russ. We're like close friends. You came to my wedding and like you're part of my close circle of friends, let's say.
I am so grateful to be a part of that circle. And I thought I would start by talking a little bit about my experience traveling to Lebanon. Mm. For your wedding, which was an amazing trip and an amazing wedding. It was 2013, so I remember like all of the foreign guests we were all a little bit nervous because it was during the height of the Syrian civil war. And President Obama had said that Assad had crossed a red line after a reported gas attack in Syria. Mm, yeah. And so it seemed like the U.S. might do an airstrike in Syria. That was what everyone was sort of nervous about at the time.
There was something else also. There were explosions in the north, if you remember.
That's right, yes. There was like bombings.
That were related to the Syrian conflict.
Right. Yeah, which, like, you know, there's a, as I'm sure we'll get into, there's like this entangled relationship between Syria and Lebanon that, that also I'd imagine is still playing a role in politics there today. But anyway, we were all a bit nervous. And then once I got to Lebanon, what I actually found was, you know, this incredible place with a strong sense of history and a really fascinating history, ancient history, modern history, layers of several centuries worth of architecture that all sort of exist on top of each other, a diversity of cultures and religions. There's Sunni Muslims, Shia Muslims, Christians, Druze. There was even, at the time, a Jewish temple that was being restored in downtown Beirut. I remember we walked by the construction site where they were doing the renovation.
Yeah, there was a vibrant Jewish community at some point. I don't know if you remember, but it was my master's thesis at Columbia.
I do remember that. Yeah. And I remember how clearly, like, in addition to all this history, or perhaps like the most robust signs of it were the impact of the wars of the Lebanese Civil War, and also the more recent wars with Israel. And you could see, you know, burnt out buildings sort of sprinkled around parts of the city. There was a place where, like, me and some of our other friends were staying close to downtown that had, like, bullet holes on the outside, on the facade. So it was clear to me that this was, like, a very complex place that had, like, a sort of melancholy to it, but also, like, a vibrancy and a sophistication, a very sort of, like, heady place that was very much alive, despite everything it had been through. And the people, as I remember, like, had this very robust appreciation for leisure, for food, for music, for partying, like they do in a lot of places in the Mediterranean in general. But yeah, like a very strong sense of hospitality, and the food in particular. You know how much I enjoyed the food. Is as good as it is anywhere in
the
world.
It's really good. It's not because it's, you know, my people's food, but it's really, really good.
No, I like the amount of times I had like a roasted lamb or just like seafood or even shawarma and falafel, all that stuff is like amazing. And of course, your family was so gracious and hospitable. So we all felt not just like we were at home, but like we were sort of honored guests there. And of course, your wedding was beautiful and so much fun. So I and our other friends got, I think, what is like a rose-colored and sort of idyllic picture of what Lebanon is or what Lebanon can be. And in retrospect, I think I was very lucky to be able to visit at a time when I could observe and enjoy all of those things, because perhaps moments like those have been fleeting in Lebanon. So anyway, that was my experience as an American in Lebanon. What do you think I got right, or what do you think I got wrong? And what would you add if you were trying to explain to someone what Lebanon is for you?
No, I think you got it all right. At least this is the experience for an outsider, right? For a foreigner that visits Lebanon. And I have so many friends who come from abroad to visit or even to live there and work there for a few years, mostly journalists. And everything you say is right. And I think quite on the contrary, like, you paint a good picture that's not too cliche. You understand that the place is very complex. And it's been through a lot. I mean, what you haven't experienced is basically life in Lebanon. You were there as a visitor, which is very different. I mean, take everything you've said, but just add to that like a life of survival, mostly because of these boom and bust, you know, cycles of violence and war, a completely corrupt political establishment that has led Lebanon to somehow its demise recently. And the fact that, you know, we are divided. I mean, we stand united in moments of crisis, and I love that. And there's a lot of solidarity. But internally, we're very much divided, and that has been invested by other countries, other powers, and we've let that happen to us throughout history. I think, you know, in my book, there's a historical chapter about Lebanon's modern history, and I call it a dysfunctional compromise. And I think it's because we always made these compromises internally and externally that made us weaker and not stronger and have weakened the state. And I think, you know, what you paint in terms of people who love to live and go out and eat, and which is very similar, of course, to other Mediterranean countries. But I think even more so in Lebanon, because ours is a life of survival and we don't know what will happen tomorrow. So people make the best out of what they have. I admire this, but at the same time, I've come to see it as a problem. And I talk again in my book for the listeners who would like to read it. It's called All She Lost. I talk about what we, you know, what's been known as the resilience of the Lebanese. And I say it's a myth. It's true that the Lebanese keep on going and, you know, they stand up every time after every crisis, after every war. But this, you know, adaptation, kind of conforming to this life that we have, which is not normal. I mean, I've had a good life in Lebanon, but in retrospect, after I left, because I've been living in Paris now for 3 years, I left after the Beirut blast. I realized that my life was never normal. You know, I lived constantly with the fear of war, you know, wars happening every now and then. My childhood was, you know, all about power cuts and, you know, a crisis here and there, roadblocks, protests. So it was not stable and it was not normal. And you realize this once you are out and you see what normal is. And I think a lot of people take their normal lives for granted because they haven't been in places like Lebanon. And so since I've been living in the West, here in Europe, I don't take that for granted, Russ. I feel very grateful, to be honest. And my whole family is still in Lebanon, including my husband. And I see how much they struggle on a daily basis with this survival, you know, not having any sense of stability or safety. And I don't think a human being should live a life like that.
Yeah, well, it is nice that you've had the ability to experience life elsewhere now. And I also think, and personally as a Dalal Mawad fan, not just a friend, I'm happy also that you're able to travel back to Lebanon and do some great reporting, which, you know, I do plan to ask you about.
Yeah. You never disconnect from Lebanon. Most of the expats, you know, the Lebanese, there are more Lebanese outside of Lebanon than there is inside of Lebanon. There are five waves in history of mass migration. And I think the last one was in the recent years with the economic crisis and the Beirut explosion. And this is what you feel among expats all around the world, is that there's always this sense of belonging and longing, and we never disconnect from Lebanon, although we feel like we don't fit anymore, and we know it's such a broken place, but we always want to go back, and we love it so much. I always describe it as, you know, when you're in a partnership or you're married to someone who abuses you, but you still love them and you still have, you know, these memories that you long for and this nostalgia, and you go back and then you realize once you're there how much you're being abused, and it's not comfortable and it's not right and it's toxic. But then once you leave them, you're still longing. There's love, there are feelings, there are emotions. It's a very complicated relationship. You know, you grapple with an identity crisis. And I feel like for a lot of Lebanese scattered around the world, it's the same. We feel like we don't belong in Lebanon, but we also struggle to fit or belong where we are. And I always say, maybe this is our identity. It's somewhere in between. It doesn't have to be in one place.
Yeah, it must be a very complex existence.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so let's get in a little bit to Lebanon's politics, because I think it will just be valuable context for our listeners to get, you know, not just the play-by-play of Israel did this and then Lebanon, Hezbollah did that, and this is how it's impacting Lebanon. But, like, at the root of it, one thing that's sort of been on the tips of a lot of people's tongues especially here in the United States, is people love to say Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Now, I don't know that much about Lebanon's political system, but I do understand there's parliamentary bodies and there are elections. And so I've always sort of like wondered, well, what about Lebanon? Isn't Lebanon a democracy? What do you think?
At face value, it's considered a democracy. It's a parliamentary democracy. We have elections. They're free to a certain extent. There's always vote rigging, I believe. But there are like a multiplicity of political parties. The parliament is divided among the various religious groups. So it's like along sectarian lines, unfortunately. There's the diversity of media outlets, but unfortunately, they get funding from political parties and very powerful businessmen who are affiliated to some political parties. I think what's broken about Lebanon's democracy mostly is the lack of accountability. It's the impunity. It's the inability of the Lebanese to hold the political establishment or people they elect accountable. And, you know, there's, I think, an issue with our electoral system. It's been made and tailored by the political establishment, so they make sure they win again every time there are elections. But it's very much, if you look that up and if you ask experts, it is a democracy. But I think the best description of Lebanon's political system is a power-sharing system, or what we call the consociational democracy, because there's this power-sharing among the different religious groups. So we have 18 religious sects, official sects in Lebanon. And then it's interesting that you bring up the issue of Israel being the only democracy in the Middle East. And I would have to very much disagree with that. I don't think you can be a democracy if you are a state based on ethnicity or religion and you give more rights to that religion or that ethnicity, and you consider other citizens who are not Jewish as second-class citizens, and this is facts. Israeli Palestinians don't have the same rights, you know, the ones that we call the 1948 citizens. They don't have the same rights as Israelis. There's clear discrimination against Palestinians. And then we've seen how Israel has treated the media the past year, shutting down Al Jazeera's bureaus or the killing of journalists, which is a record, in history. No matter how they justify this, I think, you know, a freedom of speech, freedom of expression, protection of the media, but also treating citizens equally are two pillars of any democracy. And I don't see that in Israel. It might be a democracy for the Jews, and there is internal accountability. You know, Netanyahu was put on trial for corruption, etc. But I disagree when they say it's the only democracy in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's, I guess if you just completely ignore the fact that Palestinians exist, then maybe it's fair to call it a democracy, but that's not the circumstance.
And then a democracy doesn't also, you know, occupy land. Israel still occupies land illegally as per international law. So when you look at the West Bank and East Jerusalem,
I agree with you 100%. I would go so far as to say I think Israel is an apartheid.
Yes, I it's also not us saying this. This is human rights organizations. This is including non-governmental organizations inside Israel like B'Tselem, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty. It is an apartheid state. And this is what I mean when I say there's a clear discrimination against Palestinians who are considered as second-class citizens. But it's a word that the West doesn't want to use. And I think very much, you know, Russ, Israel is what is left of, you know, European settler colonialism in the Middle East. And it very much also explains this special relationship and this totally, you know, this defensive position that the West always has towards Israel. It's, I think they are considered as Europeans and, you know, the rest, the Arabs, you know, that we're second class. We don't matter as much. I'm sorry if this sounds awful, but after this year, I think it's true. And they don't want to acknowledge this. And I think as long as there's injustice, it's very hard to find peace. This is what no one gets today. And I think the only way to address or to reach safety and peace, and that applies to Lebanon as well. I always say, you know, Lebanon's problem is impunity, because no one is ever held accountable for the crimes they commit, especially the political class. History keeps repeating itself. And I think it's very much the case with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is that we're not addressing the root cause of the problem. That is the Palestinians' right to a state, the injustice, the occupation, the illegal settlements. And as we go on, it's just getting worse. I mean, come to think about the West Bank, maybe some decades ago, we would not have imagined, you know, more than 700,000 illegal settlers as per international law living there. Today, it's the case, and it's completely jeopardized, the possibility of a future Palestinian state, because this is not land that should belong to Israel. On the contrary. And it feels like the injustices are ongoing. And I don't mean to justify any violence or so, but I think all of this needs to be understood within that historical context, is that, you know, all these grievances today, even if you get rid of Hezbollah, you weaken it militarily and you ignore the fact that it's actually a political and a social organization. Let's say there is no Hezbollah, there is no Hamas, but if there is occupation and injustice, there will be a new movement of resistance. People will, take up arms and fight for what they think is right. We've seen this across the world, not just in Israel. Israel and Palestine. And we've seen this in Lebanon, for instance. Hezbollah was the result of Israel's invasion of Beirut. There was a group of Shia clerics and members of the Shia community who took up arms. Yes, Iran adopted them and started funding them for other reasons. It wanted a proxy in the region. But it's the same, also in Gaza, that they got rid of the PLO, but there was a new group that started resisting. Maybe it gets worse even with time. But what I mean to say is that we're never going to live in peace together as long as there's an injustice.
I wanted to ask you about, maybe we could start by talking just about what we know now about Israel's plans for the ground operations, their invasion of Lebanon, and also like what you're hearing in terms of Hezbollah's capabilities to defend or fight against Israel. I want to ask you that, but then I also want to go back in time and talk about previous, like you were discussing, the previous instances where Israel has invaded.
Yeah, like 1982.
And what that's, like 1982, and what that did for Hassan Nasrallah, what that did for Hezbollah, and what this current, sort of reaction we might expect within Lebanon to the current war.
So the PLO started operating, in Lebanon in the 60s as resistance against Israel.
Maybe we should say what the PLO is. This is the Palestinian.
Okay. So the Palestinian Liberation Organization started operating. I mean, it's leadership and it's resistance fighters started operating from Lebanon in the 60s, and very much divided the Lebanese. You know, there were political parties, especially on the Christian side, not all Christians, but like most of them, who did not want, Lebanon to be involved. They didn't want them there. By then, already there was a huge also Palestinian refugee community, which is still there to this day, estimated at more than 200,000. But I think the turning point was what we know as the Cairo Agreement, which is an agreement that was reached in 1969. Between Yasser Arafat, the leader of the PLO, the Lebanese army commander, and Abdel Nasser, the late Egyptian president. this was, you know, a time also when you had two camps, Nasser, you know, the pan-Arabism and the Eisenhower doctrine and the, you know, the American camp. And you would see that divide within Lebanon. And so you had people who were pro-PLO, pro-Nasser, pan-Arabism, using Lebanon to fight for the Palestinian cause, and those that were closer to the West and the Americans, and mostly Christians, as I said, and were against this. But the Cairo agreement legalized, and if you want, the PLO's activity in Lebanon. And it's considered as a turning point because it further divided the Lebanese, you know, on where they stand on this. And this was 6 years before the beginning of the civil war. And the Palestinian activity in Lebanon, you know, increased after this and in the 70s, especially after the Black September in Jordan, when, you know, they were killed and expelled. But without going into like a lot of details, the civil war, I would not say was just because of that, because the Lebanese were divided on, you know, whether the Palestinians can fight or not fight Israel from Lebanon. I think it was a trigger. There were underlying grievances. I talk about this also in my book in the historical chapter, problems with this, the power sharing system that was in place. There were economic grievances, a lot. I'm not going to go into these factors, but I would say it was a trigger. And what started the civil war was when a Christian party militia group fired at a bus with Palestinian fighters. It's known as the Ayn al-Rumana bus massacre. And so, you know, the civil war would start. Some of the division lines at the beginning were really on that, but later on, even after the PLO was expelled in 1982, after, I'll get to that, the Lebanese kept fighting each other. And this is what I mean, it's not just that. So, and it was not just a sectarian civil war, as some people would call it, because eventually the Christians killed each other and the Muslims killed each other. So it was much more complicated than it's sometimes painted by the Western media. But in there was a first Israeli invasion in 1978, but that was just like in the south, and it stopped at the Litani. The big invasion, the Litani River, that's in the south of Lebanon. But the big invasion was in 1982, and it's very ironic that today the Israelis are talking about a limited operation because they said the same in 1982, and then they ended up reaching all the way to Beirut. And I've met a lot of people that lived through this invasion, and it was terrible because the Israelis sieged west of Beirut for about 7 weeks. There was no power, no electricity, no food, no water. And eventually, you know, the PLO was expelled, the leadership, there was a deal, they went to Tunisia. But what followed was, one, the assassination of a newly elected president that represented, you know, this one of the Christian parties that were kind of seeking a deal with Israel, I would say, and were opposed to the Palestinian presence in Lebanon. He was assassinated. And then his party, after his assassination, was involved under the supervision of the Israelis in what is known as the Sabra and Shatila massacre. It's a horrible massacre where thousands of Palestinian refugees were killed in the Sabra and Shatila camps in Beirut. And, you know, the civil war went on until 1990. But yeah, people have very, very gruesome and gory memories of that invasion, which...
Including, by the way, Israelis.
Yes, yes. It was a very bad experience. Yeah.
Huge toll on the IDF, relatively speaking, as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And the objective was really to also weaken and, you know, debilitate the Palestinian Liberation Organization and kind of turn things in Lebanon in favor of Israel and its allies. And it was seeking, you know, a kind of a government that would ally itself to Israel. And that didn't work out. I just mentioned the president that was killed and the massacre. It was very destructive in terms of, like, you know, casualties and death. And it led to the Israeli occupation of the south of Lebanon for 18 years. So from 1982 to 2000. And yes, it was a setback for the PLO in the sense that Yasser Arafat and other leaders went to Tunisia, forced to leave. But there was a new resistance to Israel that was born. One of them, or namely, is Hezbollah. So you had a group of Shia clerics and, you know, members of the Shia community who took up arms. Some of them were part of another Shia party known as Amal, which still exists to this day. So they left this and they formed another group. And they were funded and supported by Iran, who was seeking, you know, to expand its power in the region. And so Hezbollah was the perfect proxy. So, you know, the war went on, and then Hezbollah, after the civil war, after this peace agreement was reached among the different Lebanese factions, was in this agreement known as the Taif Agreement. Hezbollah, there was an agreement among the Lebanese that Hezbollah would not disarm. It would be the only party that would keep its weapons because Lebanon was still occupied by Israel, and it would play the role of resistance and kind of try and liberate the occupied south. And it kind of did. I mean, Hassan Nasrallah is the leader of Hezbollah that was assassinated by Israel last week. Is remembered to be behind, you know, the liberation of Lebanon. And I think the Israelis also have a very bad experience of that occupation. I mean, you can ask them, but I've read a lot about this. And in 2006, there was also an invasion, but it was very limited, and then they pulled back, and the price was very heavy. And this leads me to what you were asking me earlier about, you know, does Hezbollah have the capacity to fight Israel? I think we always said, and I'm not a military expert, but this is what you will hear, is before Hezbollah took all these blows, so the major infiltration intelligence breach with the pagers and the walkie-talkie attacks and the top commanders' assassinations, including the leader, but also all these commanders of the Radwan force, which is the elite force in Hezbollah. We always said that Hezbollah has an upper hand in any fighting on the ground. This is a militia. It masters guerrilla warfare. It fought along.
They've spent the last 15 years, however long, in Syria now.
Exactly. That was my next point, is that they gained considerable experience in Syria also, because they went in and to try and save Assad during the conflict. And it is known that if it weren't for Hezbollah, Assad would not have lasted. And so they know the south of Lebanon more than the Israelis, you know, the valleys and the caves. And it's believed that they have underground tunnels, miles and miles of those. But the question mark today is, because all of these top commanders have been killed, you know, it's clear that Hezbollah has been weakened militarily. Yes, it still has this huge arsenal weapon. I mean, for the listeners who don't know, Hezbollah is probably the most powerful non-state actor in the world, because it has the largest weapons arsenal for a non-state actor. It's been weakened, and so there are serious question marks as to whether it can fight on the ground without this leadership. But they have thousands of fighters. At one point, Hassan Nasrallah, I remember earlier in the summer, said they have 100,000 that they can mobilize. So this is huge. And as I said, you know, they know the ground very well. And they have all these caves and tunnels. The last I heard, in the past 24 hours, 8 Israeli soldiers have been killed. I don't think that's little. And we were saying that, you know, this blow to Hezbollah's communication network and the assassination of all of these commanders was a prelude to a probable ground invasion. And it's exactly what happened. There's a video of me, like, talking about this 2 weeks ago. But we were still wondering, you know, whether the Israelis are aware of, you know, how risky this can still be, because, you know, they've been pushed back before, and this is a guerrilla. It's not a conventional army. They said it was going to be quick and limited. I don't even know what that means, but I very much remember that a year ago, this is exactly what they said when they went into Rafah in Gaza. And look at us, 1 year on, they've completely stalled. I really don't think they've weakened Hamas for us, to be honest. The only thing they've been able to achieve is, you know, destroying Gaza and killing more than 40,000 people, mostly women and children. I don't see how Hamas is weakened. Quite on the contrary, it's even gained popularity outside of Gaza, such as the West Bank. Because we go back to what we said, that grievances and injustice breeds more violence and people will take up arms eventually again.
Yeah, I think this is a perfect place for me to ask you about the article you wrote in New Lines magazine, which I highly, highly recommend the listeners of this podcast to go and read. And the reason why I think that it's so timely to have this article now is what you were just saying, which is like maybe Hamas has been weakened in Gaza, like in terms of who Hamas was before October 7th and who Hamas is now. But these organizations are like living beings that have the capacity to recreate themselves, recruit new people, appoint new leadership. If I'm not mistaken, Hassan Nasrallah became the head of Hezbollah after the assassination of a previous leader. So talk a bit, if you can, in your article, you spoke with...
Mothers of fighters, of Hezbollah fighters.
Of Hezbollah fighters, and you get some real insight into the motivations of the fighters and what the organization and the fight means for these families. Talk a bit about your reporting and what you know about like whether Hezbollah is recruiting at this moment.
I think they definitely still have the ability to recruit and mobilize, and I don't think those 100,000, I mean, I cannot justify these numbers or verify them, but they have a wide popular base inside of Lebanon. It's mainly the Shia community, right? Because they represent very much in their doctrine. It's more than just politics. It's the what we call the Wilayat al-Faqih, or the Islamic Republic, and their allegiance is to Iran, and they're funded and supported by Iran, and it's the reference for them, the same way maybe for Sunnis it's you know, in Jerusalem, Al-Aqsa Mosque, or like Saudi Arabia, for them it's Iran and it's Shia Islam. But what I've noticed working on this story is that religion is much stronger than politics, and it is really religion that pushes these men, most of them very young men, to join Hezbollah. But again, in Shia Islam, if you go back to history, politics and religion are enmeshed, and they go back to the killing of Imam Ali, which is considered as the first Shiite imam, and he was the son-in-law of Prophet Muhammad, and then also the killing of Imam Hussein, who was the grandson of the Prophet. And to them, their killing, or what they call the martyrdom of those two, is, you know, something that they have such an attachment to. It's a bit like the crucifixion of the Christ, you know, for the Christians, and what that means for them. That, you know, for them, this was the ultimate sacrifice for what they see as social justice and a certain cause. And so martyrdom is something like a moral high ground, something that is very, very pure and kind of, how would I say it? It's something that very noble. And they have this in their religion, and they consider martyrs almost like saints. There was a mom who told me, oh, there's this guy that keeps telling me that he sees my son in the cemetery where he's buried. And, you know, this other mom who tells me that, you know, pray for him, ask him for things, he will exhaust your wishes. It's almost like you're talking about saints. And then this, so very early on, these these men, they enroll in the scouts of Hezbollah. And when I say early on, we're talking about 3 years old. It's called Al Mahdi Scout. And they start getting this the religious teachings on Shia Islam, but also at some point the indoctrination is about the politics and what Hezbollah stands for. And then later on, when they're 10 or 11, they start military training. And some of them go fighting as early as 13 and 14, you know, underage teenagers. And there's a very, very heavy indoctrination. It's, you know, those fighters are religiously committed. The interviews I've done with these moms, you know, they paint the picture of men who were very religious, very homey, you know, they didn't go out much. They were very conservative. And they really believed, you know, in what they were doing. And to them, the Palestinian cause is a cause of justice. Again, I am saying what they say. Although, come to think about it, the Palestinians are Sunnis. They're not even Shia. So for them, it's, you know, a brother helping another brother. This is how they see it, because they're all Muslims. And the Palestinian cause is like a noble cause, and they're fighting for that. Of course, Russ, I mean, for Hezbollah, it's much more than that. This is about politics, about having clout and influence. This is about Iran's influence in the region and using the Palestinian cause for political gains. I will never say that, you know, the Iranians have the Palestinian cause at heart. I would be lying to you. This is pure, like, politics and regional, you know, power. A regional power trying to have a clout and like proxies and using the Palestinian cause to grow its influence beyond doubt. But for these men, they really believe in what they're doing. And there's, I mean, people who will read the story will see this, but there's a mom, for example, who told me that the night before her son was killed or martyred, as she calls it, he had a dream and a very religious dream where the daughter of the prophet comes and tells him, you know, holds his shoulder and tells him it's time to go. And he called his friend and told him, I think I'm going to die tomorrow. So it's very, very religious. This is what I find fascinating. And I think this is the doctrine that's hard to get rid of more than politics. And on top of politics, Hezbollah is, you know, a state within a state, or if you even want a state above the state, they have all of these social services. So a lot of these families are on the payroll of Hezbollah. And this is what I talk about in the story. And it makes you wonder if one day the money stops, will anything change? Maybe. And I think,
well, this, yeah,
just one more point. I think this very big intelligence breach that we've seen in Hezbollah, which I think has helped a lot with what happened the past week, is linked to the economic crisis in Lebanon. I think the Israelis were able to recruit people, you know, human moles, because I think this is a human breach, not just an intelligence and a technological breach, and having, you know, spies and people that worked for them because of the economic crisis. We should not belittle, you know, the financial and economic factors behind this. Another thing that was brought up is Hezbollah's involvement in the Syrian conflict was a mistake. And I think they've been trying to come back from that ever since. And Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, has been trying to, you know, clean his image since then. But that conflict also exposed them to Israeli intelligence. And there's an excellent Financial Times article that everyone should read that talks about how the Syrian war exposed them, exposed their network. You know, secrecy is at the core of Hezbollah. It's very much part of their DNA. And they've taken a very big hit recently with that, because they've been exposed, you know, with these pagers that they thought were safe. There were pictures and videos of Hezbollah members and fighters all over social media with phones that were not safe, etc. So, yeah, this is, they took a big blow, Russ, probably the biggest since their inception in 1982.
So one thing I wanted to go back to that you were just talking about, I think perhaps it's worth examining a little bit further. So you're talking about the economic factors that contributed and probably have always contributed to recruitment and the Shia population's involvement in Hezbollah in Lebanon. One thing I noticed from your reporting, and perhaps it was just a sense that I got, was that these are also not people and families and young men by and large who have the same economic opportunities, like, for example, you and I and our friend, our other friends, your friends in Lebanon who went to the American University of Beirut and got to become professionals. My understanding is the south of Beirut and the south of Lebanon is perhaps a little more poor, and that the Shia population, in part because of the power sharing agreement, is not as prosperous. Is that and so I guess I'm curious, you're saying there's this religious component to their sense of purpose and belonging in Hezbollah. I wonder also how much of it is, if they had other options, if they
It's a very good point. So I think the economic factor is important. It was important with the inception of Hezbollah and the Amal movement also, that I, which is another Shiite party in Lebanon, because the Shias were always considered as marginalized and disadvantaged, and in the south and even in Beirut. And so these parties were also born partly to fill that void and provide services and cater to this community. I wouldn't say they're today the Shia are as disenfranchised and marginalized as they were some decades ago. Some of them are very, very wealthy. You know, they're in control of the expat community in Africa, for example. Wherever you go in Africa, it's the Shia Lebanese who are, you know, the head of big companies and businesses, etc. And there are very wealthy men today, especially abroad, who are playing the role of individual funders and conduits of Hezbollah's financial network, including the criminal network, etc. But yeah, if you look at the profile of the fighters, true indoctrination starts very early on, but then many of them choose not to go to university because of that. And so they don't get the education they need. The way out, by the way, according to the research I've done, is for them to go to Africa and work in Africa. Then they don't become fighters. And a lot of parents that I've spoken to, it's ironic. They say, oh, we tried to send them away where their siblings or their cousins are, but they didn't want to. They really wanted to fight and stay with Hezbollah, because you have people, you know, who are members of Hezbollah or affiliated, but they don't necessarily fight us. They just play other roles or, yeah, and they are abroad. But for sure, I mean, when you visit the suburbs of Beirut, it's not the most wealthy, it's not the, but economic factors play, but I wouldn't say it's a major factor anymore for this community. But I think in general, for all communities in Lebanon, the fact that the state is weak or quasi absent and doesn't provide services, and this, by the way, is a vicious cycle, because it's the political establishment that is weakening the state so it cannot play its role, so that their political parties are actually the ones doing the work so that they can stay in power. It's what we call a patronage network. And so Hezbollah, yes, comes in just like other political parties and fills the shoes that are supposed to be, you know, supposed to be the role of the state. And they provide all these kind of services, including, by the way, even after the fighters die, their families are on a lifetime payroll, by the way, and they get free education, free healthcare services, etc.
Right. Well, there is someone who has a solution to Lebanon's political quagmire. That person is Jared Kushner. And I don't know if you read, I sent you this tweet. Apparently he pays for a subscription to X, which grants him the ability to tweet these
very
these
long
essays.
Yeah, he has a and I won't premium read the whole membership. Thing
because it is yeah, he clearly is on some sort of premium arrangement. I am not going to read the whole thing because it's painfully long, but I just have some highlights here that get at part of the dynamic that we're outlining. And what Jared Kushner, one of the geniuses behind the Abraham Accords, which proved so successful, this is his plan for Lebanon. Okay, he says, I've spent countless hours studying Hezbollah, and there is not an expert on earth who thought that what Israel has done to decapitate and degrade them was possible. But he's talking, he sent this just after the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah. He says, Iranian leadership is stuck in the old Middle East, while the neighbors in the GCC, those are the Gulf states, are sprinting towards the future by investing in their populations and infrastructure. They are becoming dynamic magnets for talent investment while Iran falls further behind. As the Iranian proxies and threats dissipate, regional security and prosperity will rise for Christians, Muslims, and Jews alike. Israel now finds itself with the threat from Gaza mostly neutralized, citation there needed, and the opportunity to neutralize Hezbollah in the north, also citation needed. It's unfortunate how we got here, but maybe there can be a silver lining in the end. Anyone who has been calling for a ceasefire in the north is wrong. There is no going back for Israel. They cannot afford to finish the job. They cannot afford now to not finish the job and completely dismantle the arsenal that has been aimed at them. They will never get another chance. And then he goes on to say, after the brilliant rapid-fire tactical success of pagers, radios, targeting of leadership, Hezbollah's massive cachet is unguarded and unmanned. Most of Hezbollah's fighters are hiding in their tunnels. Anyone still around was not important enough to carry a pager or be invited to a leadership meeting. Iran is reeling as well, insecure and unsure how deeply its own intelligence has been penetrated. Failing to take full advantage of this opportunity to neutralize the threat is irresponsible. And basically, I think he echoes an argument that I've heard made by other Zionists on the internet that Lebanon at large would welcome an Israeli invasion and the destruction of Hezbollah. And what does he say here? There's a moment to stand behind the peace-seeking nation of Israel and the large portion of Lebanese who have been plagued by Hezbollah and who want to return to the times when their country was thriving and Beirut was a cosmopolitan city. The main issue between Lebanon and Israel is Iran. Otherwise, there's a lot of benefit for the people of both countries from working together.
Yeah. Well, there's so much to say here, but let me start by saying when Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982, there was no Hezbollah. It's the same when it was killing Palestinians before, 1988, when there was no Hamas. It will get rid of Hezbollah in an ideal scenario, but the way it got rid of the PLO, not really. And then there was something else that came out. I mean, we've mentioned this before. There was a huge security breach for both Iran and Hezbollah. And I think they decapitated the leadership. But that doesn't mean, it's the end. I don't think we're there yet. I think it's too naive to say it's the end of Hezbollah. We have to wait and see. This is what I would say as a wise journalist. I don't know what their real capacities are and how much they're going to be able to regroup and reorganize. But let me tell you this. The successor of Hassan Nasrallah, they say that Hassan Nasrallah was worse than al-Musawi, the guy they killed in 1992 that he replaced. And today they say that Hashem Safieddine, his supposed successor, which they haven't announced, is even less pragmatic than he is and even more ruthless. And it's the same, I think, for Hamas. They ended up killing Haniyeh, who was known to be a pragmatic, and he was key in the negotiations for a ceasefire. And Sinwar is not Haniyeh. He's less diplomatic, less pragmatic. So I feel like the Israelis, are always justifying and actually creating monsters. And I mean, I don't need to go into there, but people can go and research, and Israeli officials have acknowledged this. Israel played a big role in the development and the creation of Hamas as an alternative to the PLO. And then the picture he's trying to paint is what Kushner is painting, this new world, this new Middle East, is very much what Netanyahu also mentioned a few days ago. And I think it's not too far, although Kushner is, from the Trump camp and the neoconservatives, and Kushner is very much behind the annexation of illegal annexation of East Jerusalem and the mushrooming of settlements, etc. Today, the American administration, the Biden administration, is not very far from his narrative, unfortunately. And they've given the green light to Israel to do what it wants, including in Lebanon. And I think Lloyd Austin yesterday or the day before was openly. It was the first official, I think that was yesterday, to say openly that we support the invasion of Lebanon. But I think it's too naive to paint it as, you know, this is the salvation of Lebanon and this is what the Lebanese want. Listen, Russ, and you'll see this across the spectrum in Lebanon, that you only have to get on social media and you will see this. Yes, Hezbollah was an internal problem. No one's going to lie about that. I went on TV and I said that Nasrallah was the most loved but also the most hated politician in Lebanon. He was the most powerful man, although he was not in public office. And his legacy is two things. It's some people, you know, saw him as a symbol of resistance against Israel, as the man who was able to hurt Israel, which is looked at by a lot of Arabs as an occupier. He brought back some of that dignity that Nasser also brought back in the 60s to the Arabs by, you know, standing up to Israel. 2006, Israel did not win the war of 2006. They've been trying to come back from that war ever since. And I think they've been preparing for a new war. And here we are. At the same time, Nasrallah was ruthless. He is believed to be behind a series of political assassinations, an ally of the Assad regime, fighting that nasty war in Syria, crushing the Syrian opposition, crushing the 2019 uprising in Lebanon. Hezbollah is not a free political party. They kill their foes and they kill people that, oppose them. So not defending there, but Hezbollah aside, I think there's a widespread consensus in Lebanon that Israel is not welcome. We do not want Israel to invade Lebanon. What is happening today is not just an attack on Hezbollah, it's an attack on Lebanon and its sovereignty, or whatever is left of its sovereignty. And any army that crosses the borders, the internationally recognized borders of a country, without it being called into that country, is an invader. They are invading Lebanon, and it's ridiculous that the Western media calls this, a limited operation or an incursion, or the New York Times calls it, Israel is sending troops to Lebanon, just sending them, right? They're coming with cakes and baklawa. I don't know what this is. It's ridiculous. But when Russia invaded Ukraine, because it invaded Ukraine, we had no problem calling it an invasion. So, no, I don't agree with Kushner. And then this new Middle East that he's talking about to me is a new Middle East that's, again, built on injustice and occupation. It's what the U.S. did in 2003. It's what the Israelis, invaded in 1982 and they got nothing good out of it. We're talking here about occupation and oppression. This is not a Middle East that's going to thrive. And the Abraham Accords very much are what led to the October 7 attack, because the Palestinian cause was lingering in oblivion and these Arab states were, striking all these deals for economic and financial reasons and just giving up on the Palestinian cause. No one was talking about the Palestinian cause anymore until October 7. People woke up and, right, the Palestinians are asking for a state. Everyone had forgotten about this. And the Saudis were on their way too. Now they say, we're not before a Palestinian state. But it's because there was kind of an awakening. So I think what he's saying is not realistic, and this is not a region that's going to thrive as long as there's this injustice. And it's a very imperialistic narrative. I mean, who are you to tell us, what is right and what is not right for our region, and to tell us what the Arabs want or don't want? And talking about the Gulf countries, yeah, great. Yeah, their economies are doing very well. And, they're some of them made peace with Israel and they're attracting investments, etc. But they're not free countries and they're not free democracies. My book was banned in the UAE, Ross, because I mentioned them in one sentence and I say something that is very factual. So you know how the U.S. is. They make alliances where it's good for them, shaking hands with dictators and totalitarian regimes when it suits them. It includes in Lebanon. They've also ignored a lot of, corruption and wrongdoing by the political establishment or the part of it that is allied to the U.S. If you are my ally, you are not corrupt. But if you are my enemy, you are corrupt and you're a terrorist and I will get rid of you. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. I mean, as listeners of this podcast know, they hear me every week lamenting the hypocrisy of our politics. And As someone who supposedly lives in a democracy, it is also sort of sad to me and tragic to be in an election year where you would hope that, you know, one of the most pressing issues that would get discussion and where there's a potential different path on the table is just there's complete unanimity between Democrats and Republicans about how to proceed in the Middle East. Perhaps Harris takes a more humanistic tone with her rhetoric, but the policy, as her campaign has emphasized, there's no daylight between her policies and those of Joe Biden. So, yeah, it feels very bleak from my perspective, watching the machines of the politics of my country grind on as you've so.
I mean, you know American foreign policy more than I do, but for me as a Lebanese, as an Arab, it never really changes whether it's Democrats or Republicans when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israel's interests come
first.
It
has not.
Yeah. This is how we feel as Arabs. And, you know, maybe Harris has mentioned a two-state solution, but I mean, look at it on the ground today. What state is left for the Palestinians? It's.
Yeah, they're giving weapons to the Israelis to kill more of them.
Yeah, and the illegal settlements.
With a prime minister who said there will be no Palestinian state. It's not on the table.
No, Netanyahu, from the onset of his political career, and you can dig up things in the archives that he said, this is not a man who believes in Palestinian statehood. And yesterday I had to fight with this former American official on TV, and I told him, this is not just a war against Hamas and Hezbollah. Netanyahu is waging a war against the Palestinian cause. He just wants to get rid of it once and for all and tell the world the Palestinians will never see a state. That's never going to happen. And this is what the far right in Israel wants. And that's what's very, very dangerous. I mean, it's surreal. But, you know, I don't think people in the Arab world are naive. They clearly see this.
Well, the hypocrisy is so glaring. Like, another issue that sort of seems relevant here is, you know, there's all this discussion about, well, now, I mean, perhaps by the time you're listening to this, it's already taken place. But that Israel should, you know, the analysts are saying maybe Israel will strike Iran's nuclear sites where they're developing, you know, nuclear energy. They say for, you know, civilian purposes, and the West says for nefarious purposes of making weapons. Of course, the elephant in the room is there is one country in this dispute that has nuclear weapons, and it's Israel. Mm. Although no one is allowed to admit that because those weapons exist outside of the non-proliferation treaty.
But this is why they don't want Iran to have to be a nuclear power, because Israel wants to be the only one. It wants to lead the region. I mean, I'm against all nuclear powers. I don't think anyone should have a nuclear weapon. But
either no one should have or everyone should
exactly.
have. That's kind of what I think.
I agree with you.
If everyone has it or no one has it, then there will be
more peace. To have a nuclear program, and no one talks about this, but we're all like obsessed with the nuclear program of Iran.
To me, it's one of the funniest things that happens in the State Department briefing room is when someone, and it happens every so often, someone asks a journalist will ask someone in the State Department about Israel's nuclear arsenal, and they're not allowed to admit it because, you know, there's also U.S. law that says we're not allowed to give weapons to countries that have nuclear weapons outside the treaty. Mm. So it's this hypocrisy that's so easy for people outside of the US to see, but somehow impossible for us to deal with internally.
Yeah.
I just have one more question for you.
Yes.
If that's okay. So obviously, you know, we've talked about all this bleak and tragic circumstance that we're watching unfold, and seemingly you know, more rational minded people are perhaps at this point unable to intervene to prevent further tragedy, which is horrific and really sad and discouraging. But I do wonder if you perceive, as someone who regularly goes on Western media to talk about not just Lebanon, but also Israel-Palestine, have you noticed a change in the conversation in the West about Israel and Palestine? Do you see any evolution at least rhetorically, about what is acceptable discourse?
I think in comparison to the beginning of the Gaza war, there's this slight shift, shedding light on, you know, the wrongdoing that Israel is committing to a certain extent. But I wouldn't say that's like enough. If you still compare the way the Western media has covered Russia and Ukraine and how it's covering, you know, Israel and Gaza and Lebanon today, you will see the double standards very clearly. And I think it's a great case study for like journalism students. Unfortunately, I still think the media is, justifying sometimes, or doing a lot of attribution to Israel without verifying, without vetting. And there's this obsession with the same narrative, you know, the right to self-defense, the right to defend itself, the right to exist, which makes sense and doesn't make sense at the same time. And I think it's just like you're a parrot. You keep repeating the same thing without realizing what is it that you're saying. I think to this day, there's a lot of context that is still missing from what is out there in the media. And for a lot of Western media, it still feels like history started on October 7, which I find absolutely ridiculous and not factual. Not to justify October 7, quite on the contrary. But I think as journalists, it's our job to try and understand and contextualize, right? Not justify, but contextualize. Yeah. And the bias is still there. Let's say, you know, it shifted 30 degrees or less to the center where things are even or equal. But it's not there yet at all. And this is where I think social media has played a big role in this war, because people, you know, were able to find ways to look at things the media was not giving them or sharing with them. So the media outlets were not having a monopoly over information or the sharing of information. And I feel like there's more awareness in the public. Unfortunately, some people, especially on the other side, like the Israeli side, I feel like it's still very brainwashed. But I'm finding, Russ, that there's a lot of common ground between me and a lot of Israelis. That includes intellectuals, journalists that I've been following like recently on X, who are very, very critical of Israel today and what it's doing, and critical of the occupation. And I didn't think there would be so much common ground. You know, maybe I haven't engaged directly with anyone, but I've been on panels and programs, and there is a lot that they say that I agree with, or vice versa. But I don't think that this narrative, the Israelis who are critical of Israel and occupation and what it's doing, they're not getting enough airspace or words in Western media to this day, unfortunately. You know, they don't represent the main voice. And you worked at CNN. I worked at CNN. You work in different other places. And yes, there's a shift of narrative, and that's good, but we're not there yet.
Right. I agree with you 100%. Well, thank you so much, Dalal.
Thank you for having me.
For taking this time. Yeah, and everyone, we didn't really get into Dalal's book, but if you would like more context, that I've said this to Dalal, her book is called All She Lost, and it's about the explosion in the port of Beirut, and the rest of the title is The Explosion in Lebanon, The Collapse of a Nation, and the Women Who Survive Between Civil War, Israel, and Hezbollah. One of those chapters or a portion of the book is a sort of condensed modern history of Lebanon, and it's spectacularly written. That piece and the entire book that sort of tells the story of this tragedy through the eyes of women who survived, and some of whom who perished in that explosion.
Thank you, Russ.
Is there anything else you would like to add, Dalal, or things you would like
I think I just want to say that I appreciate our friendship. I mean, you know, I've also realized that, you know, you're Jewish yourself, that I can have a very constructive conversation with you. I think we've both changed and evolved since we've known each other in many ways. Yes. And I wish more people would do that. Just listen and, you know, take a step closer to the other side and just, you know, be critical and independent and have an open mind and just see what is right and what is wrong. It's hard to find people like that, you know, anywhere. So I'm very grateful for the connection that we have.
Amen to that, Dalal. Thank you so
Thank
much
you.
for being my friend as well.
Have a great day. Bye.
حبيبي يا حبيبي بحبك.